Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. Doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing pretty good. Justin, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful. I didn't win the $1.8 billion lottery, though. I actually bought a ticket.
You hate the lottery.
I do. But
why did you play if you hate the lottery?
Oh, it was just like kind of as a joke, as a gag, because it's one of those things where we all think we might win when we have one in 800 billion chance. But then we all text on our phones when we drive, and there's like a 1 in 4, 1 in 5 chance that it's going to cause an accident. But we never think that's going to happen to us. So, you know, the moral of the story is don't text and drive.
Yeah, I don't know really how I feel about the lottery, but I didn't buy a ticket.
I did. Again, it was just as a gag, really, because I thought it would be funny if I won. The guy that hates the lottery won the biggest payout in like a decade or a century. So, yeah. But then I would have had to go into hiding because I'd be afraid that everyone would murder me for the money.
Well, I could cover you on Generation Y.
Oh.
We just bring Colin back on or something, so I'd have a co-host.
Exactly. So, what's up with our Patreon?
Well, we have an influx of some new Patreon subscribers. Thank you very much to everyone that's on there. It's kind of like a Gen Y fan club, and we put out special episodes on there. And we're getting a lot of requests to just kind of shoot the breeze and talk about things and put that audio up as well.
Like current events or documentaries. I don't know. There's some documentary called like Making a Murderer Season 2 or something that probably people want us to talk about. So that'll most likely go on our Patreon because I kind of have Avery fatigue for our main feed.
People are making requests on there, and we do try to look out for our Patreon subscribers when we're releasing audio on there. But anyway, that's patreon.com/Generation Y. And I also want to thank everyone who listens to the Generation Y feed, whether you're on iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify. Justin and I were just talking today about how incredible the support is for this show and for us.
And I want to thank everyone that came out to the St. Louis meetup. It was super fun. And there was only, 30, 40 people there.
Yeah, a little over 40.
So it was nice. It was smaller. Kind of, we could take our time and talk to everyone. So it was cool.
And then earlier that day, the reason we were in St. Louis is because a true crime nurses group actually invited us out there, and we had an incredible discussion about Dr. Death.
Oh, yeah, we did. Lots of opinions in the nurses group. So wonderful, wonderful chat.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Disgraceland is a new true crime podcast about musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Jerry Lee Lewis's fifth wife, dead. Sam Cooke, 3 a.m. in a seedy motel, dead. Sid and Nancy, dead. Why? Because musicians are crazy. Because insane things happen to them. Murder, suicide, religious cults, Tupac, Beck, The Stones sleeping with the First Lady. Wait, what? If you love true crime and you love music, get ready to love Disgraceland. Listen everywhere podcasts are available.
Since it's October and we're coming up on Halloween, I know there's a new Halloween movie out, and we always think about these monsters that never stop coming after us. No matter what you do or what you think you've done, Michael Myers or Freddy Krueger or whoever is still coming to get you. So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight we're talking about a crime that occurred in the town of Skinny Atlas. That's in Onondaga County, New York, October 28th, 1998. And it involves a 41-year-old woman by the name of Jill Cahill and her husband, James Jeff Cahill, who was 38. I'm not even sure I want to go through a summary of this. We'll just say this could be one of the worst domestic violence cases I had ever heard of, if not the worst. This is horrible. Now, granted, I don't know of every single case that's ever happened. The sample size is small, but this really stands out regardless.
Jill Russell, before she was married, she graduated Tonawanda High School in 1975. She went to the State Agriculture and Technology College in Canton, graduated in 1977. She also attended Plattsburgh State College. Very educated.
Jill met and married James Jeff Cahill. He was a self-employed contractor. They would go on to have a son, Timothy, and a daughter, Mary. And at the time that this case, at least the relevant part of the case that we'll be discussing, the children were 10 and 9.
Jill was 41 years old, and James, or Jeff, was 38 years old. Jeff came from a very strict Catholic background and was very close to his family, especially his mother. Jill was doing a landscaping gig, so she became the breadwinner in the relationship and felt that Jeff wasn't pulling his weight, felt that Jeff was not trying any longer. He was becoming very controlling, telling her what to do, telling the kids what to do,
and not allowing her to be the parent, even though she was the one that was paying all the bills. So she became very resentful towards him as he was becoming resentful towards her for whatever skewed reason in his head.
Now, in the fall of 1998, the couple, their relationship was not doing well, and they were already separated at that point. Divorce was imminent.
First, they separate, and they're still living under the same roof, still in the same house. And then she's filing divorce papers. And of course, this isn't flying well with Jeff because he's become more and more aggressive and more violent towards her. And it's to the point where she actually told her sister, if Jeff kills me, you can have all my things. So it's getting to that point where she's trying to remove herself from a bad situation and even giving her sister a heads up. He's probably going to try to kill me if I leave.
April 21st, 1998, there's a terrible argument between the two of them. Jill tried to remove herself from that situation by going to the bedroom. Jeff followed her into the room with an aluminum baseball bat and attacked her. While Jill is being attacked, she yells to her children who are in the home and are witnessing this, saying, please call the police.
And of course, Jeff will scream at them to go back to bed because he's their father and he's going to tell them what they need to do. But as Jill's trying to escape this baseball bat attack, he will drag her back into the room and continue beating her.
Now, after he attacks Jill and she is on the floor, Jeff calls his family. He calls his parents. And that's really weird, right? He's calling his family, but he's not calling for an ambulance. Now, I realize if you're assaulting someone with a baseball bat, I mean, why would you call the police, right?
True. He goes on to call their family doctor, right? To maybe look Jill over and possibly help her or come up with some sort of story of how she had these wounds inflicted upon her?
Well, I read that the doctor was a family friend.
The doctor calls the police as soon as he lays eyes on Jill and understands that this was an attack.
Well, see, this is kind of a crucial point here because Jeff calls other people. He calls his family. There's a doctor called, but he doesn't call the police. The doctor thinks to call the police. The police show up and they see Jill covered in blood. She's still moving a bit. And they said there was a notable indent in her left temple. So this is a savage attack. But I don't understand how Jeff can call his family and they show up. I mean, what are they doing there? They didn't call the police.
No, they're just hanging out, talking to Jeff and possibly looking after his kids or something to that effect, but total disregard for his wife, who's laying in a pool of blood with her head bashed in from multiple blows of the baseball bat. And it swelled up to, I heard, the size of a pumpkin because of skull fracturing.
I mean, they don't even know if she's going to make it. And yet, the sense that I got was they were worried about Jeff. So Jeff has some injuries, if you want to call them that, basically some scratches and some minor cuts. And we'll get into that in a moment. But Jill was taken to Upstate University Hospital. That's in Syracuse. It was estimated that she was hit in the skull at least four times. Her eye sockets were fractured and one of her arms was broken because she was trying to defend herself. They had to do emergency surgery to remove a blood clot from her brain. Over a number of weeks, she had brain swelling and some life-threatening infections. Now, Jeff was treated for his minor injuries at a different hospital, and he was taken then to the police station for questioning. Now, okay, what's Jeff's side of the story? I'm sure he told his family, but when it came to the police, he's telling them that Jill started the argument and then attacked him with a knife. And then he had to attack her to defend himself. But
he defended himself with a baseball bat over and over and over, even striking her after she was down and dragging her around, because there are drag marks and blood everywhere, to continue defending himself.
At some point, he admits that he had cut himself with a knife to make it look like he was defending himself. But, I mean, in all honesty, this is a very obvious case of domestic violence. Now, the other thing he said was that he had already attempted suicide by carbon monoxide poisoning after the attack. So while the family was there, I guess, or maybe it was, I guess it must have been before he called them. But he used a garden hose attached to his vehicle's tailpipe. But while he was getting ready to just hang out in the car and wait for death, he saw a rosary. And that goes back to what you had said about his Catholic upbringing. It must have had some effect, I guess, because he decided not to take his own life.
And the police showed up and they did find a hose in the car. But this isn't a, I was defending myself. This sounds more like a murder-suicide.
Yeah, there was no way for him to know that she was going to make it. Jill makes it. This is a long journey, but Jill is at a hospital. She's getting care, and she's fighting. She's fighting to survive.
She was in a coma for a long time. When she pulled out of that coma, she was able to open her eyes and respond to the doctors and nurses. She was able to remember her children's names and hopefully see them and hold them again and try to get back up on her feet. This process, I think she was in the hospital for 6 months, from April to October. Now, during this time, Jeff was arrested for a first-degree assault charge. And he made bail. It was over $100,000 bail, because his family was right there supporting him to bail him out.
May 11th, 1998, this is just weeks after the attack, family court ruled that the couple's two kids, Timothy and Mary, were to live with Jill's parents and aunt. The court also issued orders of protection for the children because they were there at the house. They saw what happened. Because they're witnesses, they need protection. So Jeff was not allowed to see his children, and he was not allowed to enter the university hospital where Jill was. So these orders of protection are there to protect these people from the person who would, you know, commit violence upon them.
His photograph was posted all around the hospital that Jill was being cared for at, and the nurses and doctors and security were aware of him. And I'm sure that this isn't the first time they've had somebody come into the hospital where they're under protection, but it was a big deal. And a lot of the hospital staff will reminisce on this and how they were on high alert for Jeff. Apparently, Jeff was actually watching the hospital and documenting shift changes and when would be the best time that he might be able to come visit his wife.
You were talking about the 6 months that she spent in the hospital. Well, she was improving slowly. She moved from the ICU to coma rehabilitation, and then she went on to general rehabilitation. As you said, you know, after that 6 months, she could remember the names of her children. She could speak a little bit, but it was just short, simple words. She couldn't, you know, she couldn't tell you everything that had happened, really. So this is a major recovery that she had gone through, and she still wasn't at a point where she could leave the hospital. So don't think that 6 months later, she's about to get up and walk out.
Yeah, but this is such a brutal attack, and she suffered such traumatic brain injuries and other injuries that she had to be at a hospital for over 6 months, and she wasn't leaving anytime soon.
October 27th, 1998. A nurse smelled a strong odor and noticed that Jill was having trouble breathing. What was going on, Justin?
She noticed Jill was struggling, and she smelled this odd smell. She came in. She tried to stimulate Jill and she noticed that her fingers were burning when she touched the sheets, and there was a waxy substance on Jill, and she wasn't breathing. So she alerts hospital staff to come in, and they're trying to revive Jill, trying to get her okay again, figure out what's wrong with her. And for hours, Jill suffers and struggles to breathe and then dies the next morning after hospital staff is unable to save her because she's been poisoned with potassium cyanide.
Yeah, the autopsy revealed that she was poisoned. We all know who did this, right? This is not a mystery. This isn't one of those cases where it's like, was it the brother? Was it the husband? Was it the coworker who had a thing for her? No, this was Jeff Cahill.
And Jeff had shown up to the hospital at around 10 p.m. that night. He had a really haphazard janitor jumpsuit on. He was wearing a wig and glasses, just a pathetic attempt at a disguise. And he had somehow come into possession of potassium cyanide. And he had planned this. He had bought the potassium cyanide 3 months earlier and had waited for the perfect opportunity and bought a disguise. The hospital workers will describe a man posing as a janitor, but they didn't know it was Jeff. They knew that Jeff wasn't allowed there, but not every single person out of hospital's not allowed to be there. So it didn't really come out, you know, it was out of the ordinary, but it wasn't raising alarm bells for them, which I kind of get. I know a lot of people are screaming at their speakers saying, no, they should have sounded the alarms as soon as this guy showed up. But there's a lot of people coming and going from a hospital. I've walked into many of hospitals to visit family members and never been stopped. And I could walk all over that hospital with little to no, you know, check and balance for my presence there. He's able to get in there and he forces cyanide down his wife's throat.
Jeff is arrested. Search warrants are executed. Police found in his internet search history that he had looked up how cyanide worked and how to get it. They also found a partially burned wig and a bottle of cyanide hidden in a cinder block in the backyard. There were also four letters on the computer that showed how Jeff had obtained the cyanide. In July of 1998, Jeff, using a fake letterhead from General Superplating, which that's an electroplating company that uses cyanide in electroplating, he used that to send a letter to Bryant Laboratories in Berkeley, California, and they overnighted a package of cyanide to him, and it cost Jeff $30 to do this. He knew when it was being delivered, so he followed the UPS truck, then showed up and intercepted that package saying, oh, I work for General Superplating, you can just give it to me. The UPS driver applauded this guy. He found this to be very strange, and he took down the plate of the guy who intercepted him, and he contacted the police. Or actually, he reported to the company, they reported to the police, and they said, this is very strange because we don't order cyanide from California. With the driver saying to the police, yes, I took the license plate number. This is what the guy looked like that was driving it. Well, by looking up the plate of the car, it was linked to a relative of Jeff Cahill.
There's a little bit of blame here on the driver. He shouldn't have given this guy the package, but he didn't know. It was social engineering on Jeff's part, too.
But he did take the plate number, so I mean, you, to me, that's something.
Yeah, he applaud him for what he did do. But for him to report this, and then the company to report it to the police, and the police to track it down to a family member of a man who stands accused of a first-degree assault, but let's just call it what it is. It was attempted murder. And no follow-up? Nothing? We're cool? Okay, got it.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, You have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Jill Cahill, who had fought to survive 6 months in, had, at least the way I saw it, was she was going to get better eventually. She was fighting to get back to be the mother to her children. That was her drive. Her funeral was held on October 30th, 1998. Jeff got his way. He murdered his wife with the support of his family, was able to post bail. He was able to finish what he started.
Yeah. This is Michael Myers or Freddy Krueger just not stopping, never giving up on their mission to kill somebody that they hate so much.
November 19th, 1998, Jeff Cahill was indicted by a grand jury. It was on 2 counts of first-degree murder. The first count was murder to prevent Jill from testifying against them for the assault. Remember, I mean, that's where that was headed. They were going to have her testify against him, and he would face court on that. But since she died, they're holding that against him. And why not, right?
Yeah.
Then the second count was intentionally murdering Jill during a burglary. Now, let's make this clear for everyone. The burglary is he was forbidden to enter that hospital, right? That was spelled out in the orders of protection, and he went there anyway. So this is considered a break-in.
I think that there's a problem calling it this and not just a felony trespass or something to that effect.
That sounds like it would be better, but this is how it worked in New York.
Yeah. They got him on 2 counts and aggravated criminal contempt and criminal possession of a weapon in the 4th degree. But a lot of these other charges stem from the initial attack 6 months earlier. With this culmination of charges and everything, they're going to go for the death penalty, right?
Right. And again, we've said it before, there are cases that will push you where even if you're a staunch anti-DP person, anti-death penalty person, this isn't something that you're necessarily going to lose sleep over if they put Jeff Cahill to death.
I'm one of those anti-death penalty guys, but here I'm looking at this case and thinking he is a POS and I don't care what the outcome is here because it's obvious he did it. It's obvious he is the perpetrator and this is a pretty heinous crime because it was ongoing for so long.
His trial lasts 6-7 days. It takes place in early August from the 3rd through the 9th. And the prosecution, strong case, right? They know who did it. They can illustrate to the jury, this man assaulted his wife nearly to death. And then while she was in recovery, visited her at the hospital and poisoned her to finish her off so that she couldn't testify against him in the pending assault case. Although I think it could also be argued that he just wanted her dead. And it really, you know, that assault case, I don't even know if that was the primary motivator. I don't know if I see it that way. But she was removing herself from the marriage for good reason. He didn't want her to leave. So,
and they have all the records from his computer searching for the cyanide. They have the eyewitness from the delivery driver who wrote down the plate. It's him. It's him all day long. There's no question here.
And there's testimony during the trial about Jeff visiting the hospital. A nursing assistant, and this is about a week before Jill was murdered, she was working at the hospital, and she testified that she saw Jeff Cahill in the hospital disguised as a janitor. This woman's name was Donna Lee Holloway, and she said that she saw him on either October 19th or 20th, and that he was crouched down, his head was low, and he was dust mopping the hallway. So she approached him, and she said that instead of his uniform being the typical blue, it was like white painter pants, and he was wearing work boots. She said that he appeared to be wearing a wig with red highlight in it. She was keeping an eye on him, and then she saw him go into Jill's room. And so she followed him in there, and she just asked him, "Hey, is there something I can help you with?" And he replied that he just came down to say hi to Jill, and he walked right out of the room. So you wonder, it's like he's testing the hospital defenses, essentially. How close can I get? And I think he knew then that as long as he was careful, he could get in that hospital. Just like you said, you can walk around a hospital, and who's going to bother you? August 10th, 1999, Jeff Cahill, surprise, surprise, found guilty of two counts of first-degree murder in the death of Jill Cahill, first-degree assault, and, of course, other related charges. After his conviction, Jeff entered the penalty phase of the trial. His defense attorneys here tried to humanize him. You can't put this guy to death. He's a real person. Stuff happened, but let's not go that far with this. And they had 21 character witnesses, some of whom described him as a calming force.
Calming force, huh? I'm assuming a baseball bat swinging multiple times to somebody's head is a calming force, or whatever.
August 20th, 1999, he was sentenced to death by lethal injection for both of his first-degree murder convictions. The DA said afterward, and here we go again with plea deals, they had offered Jeff Cahill a plea deal which would have given him life in prison. It would have, you know, removed the death penalty, but Jeff didn't take it.
Okay, so remember that. Remember that detail. He was offered a plea for life, and he rejected it.
In 1995, there was a capital punishment law passed that made the New York standards the same as the federal standards. So it said that there were 13 aggravating factors that could make a person who committed murder eligible for the death penalty. Jeff Cahill's crime had just two of these factors. One was witness elimination, and the other was intentional murder in the course of burglary, or I like how you say trespass, that makes more sense. But, you know, the defense team for Jeff appealed his sentence based on 38 points. And his appeal was argued on September 22nd of 2003. It's later that year in November when the New York Court of Appeals overturned the death sentence of Jeff Cahill in a 4-2 decision. There are factors here, mitigating factors here, three of them. One, the trial judge, they said he erred when he screened the jurors. He had ruled incorrectly on two jurors in the screening process. One favored the death penalty too much. So they're like, he's biased. The other was of the right mind about the death penalty, I guess more objective, but was dismissed from the case when she should not have been. So sounds like they were trying to tailor the jury a little bit.
They always are trying to tailor the jury, and jury selection is pretty much can sway an entire case. So
this, absolutely.
Yeah. This is all part of the tactical strategy of the legal system.
You lose the battle, but maybe you'll win another one. Maybe your client does better in the end. We'll see how it turns out. The second one, the court stated that in order to convict someone of murder for witness elimination, it had to be the most important motive. So remember, The question here is, did he kill his wife so that she couldn't testify against him? Or did he kill his wife because he wanted her dead? And it really didn't have anything to do with that assault case. Well, there are multiple motives here. And to say that witness elimination was the primary reason, that's debatable.
Yeah, it's the whole argument was that he murdered Jill to eliminate a witness to the assault charge. The defense says that Jeff had already confessed to the crime, and the prosecution had such a strong case without Jill's testimony that killing her wouldn't have made a difference.
That makes a ton of sense.
Well, and they say, to put it plainly, the defendant wanted to kill Jill at the hospital for reasons that virtually had nothing to do with her ability to testify against him. So his intent or reason why he wanted to kill her makes it all okay, kind of. And let's just pause here for a second, because if his intent matters and that's what we're basing this legality on, well, just put things in perspective here. If you're walking down the street and you have over a certain amount of marijuana in your pocket, yeah, here's Justin going off on his war on drugs tangent again. If you have over a certain amount, the laws reflect that you have intent to distribute, and there's no arguing it.
Yeah, there's no research to figure out whether you were going to sell it.
No, or if it was just, I'm going to smoke it all myself. No, it's, you have this amount, you're a distributor now. And we don't split hairs on that with drug dealers and drug possession charges. Yet, we say we're tough on crime, but here's a guy who just beat his wife with a baseball bat and then came back and killed her with cyanide later. But we're going to split hairs over what was his intent when he did this? Was he trying to get rid of a witness? GTFO.
It's funny because how many times do we say it? Even if you're guilty of the crime, the court needs to look out for you somewhat. I mean, we can't just throw all your rights out. I mean, there are protections for a reason. But just like you pointed out, though, this is starting to feel like splitting hairs.
Hey, defense attorneys and whatever are supposed to do this stuff. I get it. Keep going to the next point, Aaron.
Okay. Point three, court stated that Jeff didn't commit burglary and murder Jill in the commission of that crime. Why? Because burglary refers to the act of illegally entering a place with the intent to commit a separate crime. So in other words, he didn't go there to steal anything, right? He didn't go there to break in. He went there to murder someone. So this whole burglary thing really doesn't make a lot of sense. Well, but again, why are we worried about tacking it on or not? I mean, what difference does it really make? He was told not to go there.
And I guess this is the issue. If they would have called it felony trespass, then it would have fit, as opposed to him trying to steal something. Yeah, that would have fit.
Because that's what we all think. When you say burglary, we're thinking, well, what were they taking?
Yeah. Now, why they didn't charge him with fraud with the intent to acquire a deadly substance, using that deadly substance in the commission of a crime, just like gun charges. You know, if you go and kill somebody, not only are you charged with their murder, but you're charged with it in the commission of a murder, use of an illegal weapon or something to that effect. But no, they don't charge him with any of these things. They throw some weird charges at him that I guess are easily shot down in an appeal. So as much as this pisses me off, this is the system working. The state didn't do their due diligence and they weren't creative enough with their charges against this man. So the defense is able to tear it apart.
Remember, he was convicted on 2 counts of first degree murder. These counts were shifted to 1 count of second degree murder, as a result of this appeal. The court said, yeah, you can't have 2 counts of first degree here. So it goes down to 1 count of second degree. Jeff is then sent back to the trial judge for resentencing.
Now, for all of you that are thinking, how is he getting second degree murder charges? Because we all have this thing in our head that first degree murder is premeditated. Well, just depends on the state you're in. State to state, it doesn't matter if it's premeditated or not. State to state, sometimes deliberating for just a mere moment causes premeditation. But in the state of New York, has nothing to do with this being planned, premeditated, or anything. Has more to do with him committing murder in the commission of another crime. And that's what gets it first degree, and that's what gets it a death penalty sentencing. So now we're down to a second degree murder charge, which carries a lot less time than a life sentence.
It does. Remember, at the time, Jeff was just 38 years old. In 2004, Jeff was sentenced to serve 25 years to life for the murder and 12 and a half to 25 years for the assault. So these two sentences were to be served consecutively. That means one, then the other, right? Just like two follows one.
Yeah.
This means Jeff's eligible for parole in 2036 after 37 and a half years in prison.
He'll be like 75 years old at that time.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
Another thing on his appeal was the officers found the empty bottle of cyanide out in a shed, stuck in like a cinder block. The warrant only names the house for the property and doesn't specify another structure on the property. So, of course, the defense wants this deemed inadmissible because it wasn't part of the warrant. But the judge shoots that down.
In December of 2007, Jeff appealed the decision. He wanted to serve his sentences concurrently. That's for the assault and the murder. And that would reduce the time so that he would be eligible for parole in 25 years.
It'll be 2024, and he'll be 64 years old.
Now, in comes Deborah Yeager. And Deborah Yeager is Jill's sister. And she, at the time, said, "I just hope it doesn't happen for my parents' sake. They got it right the first time," talking about when he was sentenced to death, meaning Jeff. "This appeal was denied. Jeff Cahill won't be eligible for parole until 2036. So Deborah Yeager got her wish, ended up the way she wanted it. It's still bad because now he's eligible for parole at some point, but it's much further down the line.
This is the importance of victim impact statements, victims taking control of a parole board, and the importance of parole hearings, reaching out to surviving members and victims and letting them know what's going on. Because a lot of times, victims are just sitting back and they're not hearing anything. And they have to call the court systems, they have to call the prisons and find out. And even then, they're not always privy to the information because they're not a family member of the accused. So without her, this guy might have got his way.
Tim and Mary, the Cahill children, ended up with Deborah in Tonawanda, New York. Deborah, she's with other family members on this, they were championing a law called Jilly's Law. And what they wanted to do was to make it more difficult for people accused of domestic violence to get out of jail quickly. The goal of this law is to make it more difficult for people who were accused of domestic violence to get out of jail quickly. I mean, this case is an extreme example of what can happen. You know, it allows judges to take into account the impact on victims, on witnesses of crimes when setting bail, so that they can make sure that someone can't just come back out and finish what they started.
And to put this in perspective, the only factor that judges are allowed to consider when issuing or denying bail is whether or not the accused will reappear in court. So Gilley's law is spelling out that if the defendant is a danger to the alleged victim in the criminal action or to members of the community or to themselves, if the defendant has a history of violence, if the defendant had an order of protection, if the nature of the defendant's criminal record is heinous, if violent natures of crime, it allows them to take in all of these considerations and not just, is the guy going to show back up in court?
It's almost too simple a way of looking at it because it's just distant enough that you can't make that connection. This law was introduced in 2004. Deborah has an extensive background in dealing with domestic violence issues because she has been a part of a group, Family Justice Center, and they're based in New York. Because she understands it and she knows what happened to her sister, she wanted something done about this. Now, the sad thing is Gilley's law doesn't pass. The good news is that in 2012, there was a comprehensive domestic violence law bill that was passed in New York. And part of it did contain some provisions from Gilley's law. It's not like a loss. This was actually a very, very good bill because, you know, for families, let's say in this case, if Jeff killed his wife, he would still have the ability to say what happened to her body. And I've heard of cases where when a husband kills his wife, he can say, yeah, I want her cremated. And then he can just have her ashes thrown on some train tracks or something. This comprehensive law makes changes so that if you kill your spouse, you lose those rights.
You would just think that this was a given already, but wow.
If you don't put it down as a law, then it's not a law. Yeah. I know that sounds crazy. It was just like when we talked about the Justin Schneider case on Patreon. That guy was able to get away with a crime because it wasn't expressly spelled out as a crime on the books. Yeah. Deborah Yeager, as I said, had been a volunteer with this Family Justice Center. They have four locations in the state of New York. Their website is fjcsafe.org. And the first thing that caught my eye when I went on their homepage is they have a red safety exit in the lower right-hand corner of the page. So if you're there and you're afraid someone's about to come in who might hurt you just because you're looking at this website, you can click that and it'll take you to the Google search page. I like the fact that they're taking a lot of things into account and they're obviously good at what they do. I mean, they provide support for people who are domestic violence victims and their children. So that kind of work is very, very honorable, I think.
I've even heard some of our listeners have told me that they have sent either a Gen Y episode or a peripheral episode to one of their friends or loved ones that's in a domestic abuse situation, and we give information out at the end of the show or the hotline or something, and it was their way of, hey, you should listen to this episode, without drawing attention. It's clever, but it's sad that it has to be done.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what people go through in those situations, so it's not like I can tell them what to do, but we all have that concern for those that are caught up in such a situation. So ideally, people can get out, they get the support they need, and they're protected from their abusers. But as we know, it just seems far too often that the abuser can continue to get access to their victim.
Now, I typically don't like to throw people under the bus, but I guess I'm feeling a little spunky tonight, so I'm about to pick a fight. The Cahill family, you know, when they show up at a victim's house and don't bother to call the police, don't bother to do anything, care for a victim, it's saddening to me. And I'm not going to say that everyone in the family is that careless or that callous or mean, but just going around on the internet and reading about this case, I came across some of the Cahill family members commenting. And if you go out to Amazon and find the book about this case, you'll find a comment from Sean Cahill that says, "This book was one side,
What happened in the relationship between Jeff and Jill? Question mark. Why was she having an affair? This book is making the Cahill name look bad. Sorry, I know what it has done to the Cahill name back in that area. Now, I don't know if this person actually is related to the family, but going off of how the family responded when Jeff beat his wife with a baseball bat, and this guy's giving the book a 1-star review, it sounds like he's accusing Jill of having an affair and that she deserved what she got. And the family name and their reputation is more important than said victim.
Yeah, it really sucks that that's their take. But, you know, sometimes there are things that happen that give us, you know, it improves the way we feel just a little bit. And so if you click the comments below his so-called review, there are some gems in there. One of them is the book. The book is making the Cahill name look bad. Tell your relatives, try not being a murderer, then you won't get a book written about you. And another person wrote, the illiteracy you show in your review, which it is not, doesn't make the Cahill name look too great either.
And if you, anyone that thought I read that weirdly. No, I read it verbatim. I intentionally read it the way it was written. Because
I think you even partially improved it a little bit accidentally. It's really a terrible, it's a terrible example of grammar. We've said this on another episode not too long ago, but you know, who won here? Jeff sought to kill his wife and it took him 2 tries, but he did it. And then in the end, he also won an appeal and got his sentence reduced.
This is sad, but true. Again, I go back to, what does tough on crime mean? Does it just mean that we're going after petty thieves and drug dealers and the poor people and not actual violent criminals? Because to me, tough on crime is somebody like this spending the rest of their life behind bars and not getting his way, not allowing him to get a first-degree murder charge bumped down to a second-degree murder charge because we couldn't prove what he intended when he went to kill his wife. That's just madness to me.
I know it seems like I'm going to end this with saying the killer won here, but I don't know that that's necessarily true. I do like that New York has passed this comprehensive law to tackle domestic violence issues, and I know that Jill's sister has been out there speaking to people. Domestic violence is never going to go away. I mean, it's here to stay, unfortunately. When something terrible like this happens, maybe the best we can hope for is that more people are educated on it and that there are more laws passed so that vile people like Jeff Cahill can't just go through the process of killing their victim in such an easy manner. I mean, really, the path was there. There were really no roadblocks to him killing his wife. It's really sad to say that. Now I think things have improved. I don't know what it would take for them to be ideal, but I hope they keep going in that direction.
I'd like to thank our sponsor, Third Love. Using millions of women's measurements, Third Love designs its bras with breast shape and size in mind for impeccable fit and incredible feel. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now they're offering our listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/GenY now for your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/GENWHY for 15% off today.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.